Tam Andricha Matparaha. Sandipani said, O my children, you have suffered so much for my sake. The body is most dear to every living creature, but you are so dedicated to me that you completely disregarded your own comfort. Etadeva hi satchisyaha kartavyam guru niskritam yadbhai vishuddha bhavina sarvatatmana param garau. This indeed is the duty of all true disciples, to repay the debt to their spiritual master by offering him with pure hearts their wealth and even their very lives. Tusto hambo dvija shrestha satya santu manorataha chandamsya ata yamani bhavantriha paratracha. You boys are first-class brahmanas, and I am satisfied with you. May all your desires be fulfilled, and may the Vedic mantras you have learned never lose their meaning for you in this world or the next. In a way, our dear friend Govinda Charandas has selected these verses from Srimad Bhagavatam today. In his letter inviting me to be with you here at Sadhu Sangha today, he closed with, quote, Your sacrifices for Srila Prabhupada reminds me of how pleased Srila Prabhupada must be, similar to how Sandipani Muni was pleased with Krishna and Sudama. And then he quoted these three verses from the 10th canto, Sudama's visit to Krishna in Dwarka. And I thought, reading this, sacrifices? Is this how the present generation of devotees see us? Srila Prabhupada's early pioneers? As sacrificing something? And I looked it up. Sacrifice means giving up something important or valued as an offering to God. So I just wanted to clear the air on this. Could giving up lives of uncertainty, lives poisoned by material concepts and substances, lives of depression and anxiety, exhausted by the futile search for fleeting empty pleasures, to be replaced in our lives by the certainty of absolute knowledge, to have a life with purpose and laughter and deep inner ecstasy, to see firsthand the beauty of this perfect person, and then to hear the words from the Swami's mouth, and then to sit down and laugh with him and be filled by his wondrous presence. Can this really be called sacrifice? No, my friends. This is pure, unadulterated luck. Good fortune. A blessed destiny that in no way can be described as sacrifice. We were a joyful bunch, the Swami's band of buccaneers, with our pilot, our general at the helm, living lives of pure excitement, and yes, joy. I'll read something from my book. Bhaktivedanta Swami is the most attractive person I've ever seen, and this guy only works for Krishna. He's the messenger. So how beautiful Krishna must be. The Swami's physical beauty seems ever fresh and energetic, fueled by a special energy like the fluid grace you see in youth. The Swami's eyes, his large mouth, his facial expressions all play together with everything he says. He would break mid-sentence, a dramatic pause, like returning to the tambura drone in an Indian raga. He seems to know everything, and I can't take my ears away. We said, okay, Swamiji, you've convinced us that Krishna is God. We are his tiny servants, bound to him in what you're calling devotional service. But now, what do we do? This was the Swami's famous reply. We should always be enthusiastic to try for capturing the rhinoceros. That way, if we fail, everyone will say, never mind, no one can catch a rhinoceros anyway. And if we succeed, then everyone will say, just see what a wonderful thing they have done. So more than anything else, I remember this, that Bhaktivedanta Swami instilled in his early students one overriding idea, to chase the rhino. Dare to pursue the biggest goals for Krishna. And this was the spirit, the subject, and the object of all of our activities. Chasing the rhino became the hue and cry of the first generation of the Swami's star-struck disciples. He said two things. You become yourself Krishna conscious, and you spread Krishna consciousness. That's it. Moreover, you become Krishna conscious by spreading Krishna consciousness. That's a two for the price of one. Chase the rhino for Krishna, become Krishna conscious. It's simple. In those early days, we had no models, no history, no maps, no books of instruction, no well-marked trails. We had only the Swami, his words, his personal example. How he had chased the rhino to America as an old man, with no money, friends, and no plan, really, under Krishna's protection. And he never conveyed to us that his was a path of hardship and sacrifice. We saw his photos, a tent standing with Indian heads of state. We saw copies of letters to presidents and popes. He never minced words. Each day he said to us, what I am telling you will save humankind. You must help me change the world. Swamiji had explained in a lecture that Krishna most appreciates devotees who risk the most on his behalf. And if you risk everything for Krishna, he must personally intervene to remove obstacles to your risky service. Well, most of us in Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco in 1967 were there at great risk, giving up the comforts of homes, educations, careers, and society to become outcasts searching for meaning. Many of us had already, at a young age, traveled widely, taken great risks with drugs and the law, and carved out an independent lifestyle. So we immediately connected with the Swami's courage vibe. We dug his message that to get Krishna, you must take risks. You can say that we were all on a great adventure with the Swami. It was the most exhilarating adventure of our lives. The Swami was this beautiful creature, this great yogi and saint, certainly the highest man we had ever met. But he pierced the veil of awe and distance and separateness to embrace our hearts like his own children. I'll dip into my book now a little and read you the description of my first personal contact or audience with Srila Prabhupada, with Bhaktivedanta Swami at that time, in January 1967. Swamiji sits lotus-style on a thin mattress on the floor behind a low coffee table, morning sun pouring through the window. I mark his radiance, his beaming wide-eyed face, his eyes looking straight into mine, the swollen bow curve and tremble of his dark, full lips around big teeth. So beautiful, I nearly faint. Motioning me now to scoot over and sit beside him behind the low table. His grace, his fragrance, which I later learn is sandalwood, he slips his glasses from a little case, takes his pen from another case, and brushing my arm with his shoulder, The soft rustle of cotton and jolts of electricity shoot through my neck, and I am overwhelmed with well-being. "Do you know bookkeeping?" he asks me. This was the Swami's management style. Chasing the rhino is risky, high adventure. That's one thing. And it was the theme of our activity. But the activity itself should be practical. Bhaktivedanta Swami harnessed what little practical talent or skills that we had and personally fit them into the larger task. He made you feel important, that your tiny service had huge consequences. And little by little, in this way, the Swami gave us someone to love, something to do, and something to hope for. These are the secrets to happiness and successful life. Again from the book. Right off, one of the things I like best about the Swami, he made you laugh. He was always calm and content, sure, but more than that, he was jolly. Even discussing various serious subjects, there was often the play of a smile around his lips, a chuckle to make a point, chuckle by chuckle building our inner glee. Then suddenly the guffaw, the quick delight. And when he's really surprised by the overtly absurd, a full-rounded belly laugh trembles his body, tears streaming from his tight, squinted eyes. He said, "You'll feel yourself transcendentally joyful in spite of your present physical body. Just like if you eat, you'll know yourself that you are eating. You are feeling strength. You are getting enlightened. Similarly, if you take this process of Krishna consciousness, in spite of your present physical body, you'll know that you are having something transcendental. That feeling will come with you. Krishna is always jolly. And if you join his society, you will also become jolly." Sandipani Muni said, "Oh, my children, you have suffered so much for my sake." But was this really suffering or sacrifice? No, indeed. In the presence of our newly found master, we were the happiest people on the planet. This indeed is the duty of all true disciples, to repay the debt to their spiritual master by offering him, with pure hearts, their wealth and even their very lives. Debt? Yes, you can say we felt this debt, but not like an obligation that pressures you to repay it. Srila Prabhupada gave us Krishna consciousness as a true gift. A gift truly given doesn't require repayment. The most precious gift liberates and frees you, empowers you to give onwards. We gave until we dropped, sure. But our efforts are insignificant compared with Srila Prabhupada's gift to us. And isn't it a little laughable to think that anything we gift to Srila Prabhupada can in any way be considered as paying back our debt to him? In this regard, I was reminded of a very cool verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam in the Canto 4, chapter 22, verse 47. I'll read it. Prithu Maharaja continued, "How can such persons who have rendered unlimited service by explaining the path of self-realization in relation to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and whose explanations are given for our enlightenment with complete conviction and Vedic evidence, be repaid except by folded palms containing water for their satisfaction?" In the purport to this verse, Srila Prabhupada comments, "The word Vinoda Patram means joker. A joker's activities simply arouse laughter, and a person who tries to repay the spiritual master or teacher of the transcendental message of Krishna becomes a laughingstock, just like a joker, because it is not possible to repay such a debt." So we're gathered here today, early in the year 2017, almost exactly 50 years from the date that Malati and I first laid our eyes on the Swami's incredible, beautiful form on January 17th, 1967. How wonderful is it that we have survived to see the unfolding of Bhaktivedanta Swami's dream. And sure, we've had our ups and downs, but we're well past the growing pains now, and the future looks very bright. There's no stopping now the spread of Krishna's name into every town and village. I have no real qualification to speak to you anything about high philosophy or anything, really. My only qualification to be with you today is perhaps that I was a witness, a close-up, an intimate witness to Srila Prabhupada's amazing appearance among us. I was the errant but capable child at his feet in San Francisco as he unfolded his plan and taught me the ropes. And I was one of his troops, and I was one of the troops in his pirate band, and then his point man raising havoc on far-off lands behind enemy lines. And then an officer with troops of my own. And then, most blessed of all, the secretary, the right-hand man to my spiritual master. For nearly 2 years, I ate and slept and worked and played at the side of our master, never out of hearing from the tiny bell he rang to call me. Now, by Krishna's grace, I have survived to be the scribe, the chronicler, to tell the story of our master's deeds. Not just his deeds, but I've painted the strokes of his face and his ever-moving eyes, and the grace of his hands as they rise and fall, reject and beckon and guide us to the promised land. Over the past nearly 4 years now, I've written three big volumes of a book called Chasing Rhinos with the Swami, to recall and remember and go deep inside and to relive and describe as best I can the 7 years that I spent at Prabhupada's feet. And writing these books and going back in time like this into deep memory, never did I see these times, did I see these times as suffering or sacrifice? When I read Govinda Charan's words, granted, they were very nice words, but I was a bit astounded to think that this might be what later generations think of us as sufferers. So just read along with me now a few paragraphs from Chasing Rhinos with the Swami and see the way we really felt. Here we go. Whenever you came to the Swami's door, your heart was in your throat. This feeling never left me, even after 1,000 trips to that door. There was a heightened sense that something marvelous was about to occur, a tingling in the blood. You never knew what to expect, just that it would be a wonderful surprise. Whatever happened, he'd be sitting behind his little table, or in his rocker, clicking his beads, dressed in saffron, maybe with a white sweater, sunlight through the south-facing window shining on his freshly oiled head, and his face a radiant gold emerging from some deep bliss. And he would welcome you no matter what hour of day or night. Or this, taken from a later chapter in London. Early each morning, Prabhupada would speak from Srimad Bhagavatam in the temple room. His children gathered around. I would watch the spray of wrinkles at the ends of his eyes, like tiny feathers spread in flight. And his eyes, so doe-like, calm, yes, much like the eyes we're seeing on the white humped cows we see on the streets. Soft, liquid, and loving, with long curling lashes. Even the little dewlap under his chin is so lovable. Sometimes around his eyes you could see black outlines, almost like mascara, the eyes of Horus, the Egyptian frescoes. His hoary eyebrows were thick, unruly, and would sweep up and down with changes of mood to enhance a point to his story. breaking us in for the task at hand. Or this, when 20 of his disciples traveled with Srila Prabhupada in late 1970 to the exotic frontiers in the fabled land of India. As Prabhupada spoke on those golden mornings, the raucous caw of a crow outside, the coo, coo, coo of pigeons in the courtyard, we are mesmerized by the changing expressions across his golden face, like the play of cumulus and sunlight over a varied landscape. One moment he's from another world, so impenetrable to us, self-contained king of all he surveys. Next, he's tossing a ball at you in a friendly game of verbal catch. Maybe a fastball to see if you can catch it. He might break from describing Krishna's vast cosmic design to a real concern for your upset stomach. Just try a little bicarbonate of soda, one teaspoonful in water. No one has ever seen such depths of personality. Or this, also from the early days with Srila Prabhupada in India. Prabhupada's energy and vitality seemed to get stronger and stronger with each day. He was constantly talking to people. People would come. We never saw him sleep. He would take only a little food. He would encourage us to eat huge amounts, but he took only a little. We were so excited, full of expectation of great things ahead. Of course, there were down periods when we all felt, oh, this is too difficult living like this. I just want to go back where there are dishwashing machines and hot water. But living this close to Prabhupada just made everything so easy and so light. The whole thing was painless because it was so much fun. We didn't have anything. Sure, sometimes we were chauffeured in limos and ate huge banquets, but next day we'd be packed like sardines in a garlic breath train, eating a handful of chickpeas. The jolly mood snared us deeper and deeper into Prabhupada's tender net. We could also see the joy that he himself experienced while sporting in this world. We would go to some meeting, and he would be very grave and stern, maybe chastising his own countrymen for allowing Krishna consciousness to fade in the world. And then we'd return to our quarters and sit down there with Prabhupada into the night, and he would recall something funny that happened at the program and break into uproarious laughter. Here was a typical day for Srila Prabhupada. Shamasundar, take dictation. These were usually the first words I heard in the very early morning, maybe 5 a.m. Prabhupada has been up all night, translating, chanting his rounds. He might be ready to dictate replies to letters he had received yesterday, or he might ask me to open and read newly arrived letters. I would take notes as fast as I could. Or he might want to discuss points raised in the letters, from mundane, like health tips to Saradia in Trinidad, who has a stomach ailment, to a 5-page description of the expansions of Vishnu for Madhavisa in Australia. For an hour or so, he would manage this way his far-flung enterprise and then ask for his coat and cane. It was time for morning walk. He would walk a mile or two, or sometimes more, and then speak in the temple if there was one. Then he retired to his room for a light breakfast, and for more than a year, today's philosophy session. One day in London in August 1971, Srila Prabhupada asked me, "So you have studied philosophy in university?" I said, "Yes, Srila Prabhupada." He said, "Well, then you will come each morning from now on and we will debate Western philosophy." So I ran to the bookstore and I found an outline of Western philosophers. And we started with Aristotle. We went all for more than almost a year. Every day I sat with Srila Prabhupada and I became the philosopher and he debated me. And we started with Aristotle, and over the months we worked all the way up to Camus and Heidegger and the modern phenomenology. And he defeated me every time. After an hour of arguing my side, Prabhupada always won. Every time. And thanks to Ekanath and his dear wife at the archives, Bhaktivedanta archives, somehow or other these conversations or these discussions, philosophy discussions, were preserved. And I dug them out, edited them slightly to make them flow better. And they're in the book, in the coming volumes of my book. And then after an hour of this philosophy discussion, Srila Prabhupada would meet with devotees or his guests all day. And we caught on to a secret that Srila Prabhupada loved to speak and converse with intelligent and thoughtful men and women. He thrived on this. So I sent out the word. And wherever we went, the devotees brought intelligent people, from the village policeman to famous rock stars, to sit and talk with Srila Prabhupada. I recorded as many as these as I could of these conversations. And these are also in my later volumes as Chasing Rhinos. I tried to identify who the person was in many of the conversations. That's been lost. And then edit them a little to bring out the essence, because these conversations are so amazingly important. Srila Prabhupada was faultless in every talk. His sense of timing, what he said, blew my mind every time. Srila Prabhupada was always a surprise. Often I thought, when he would be talking somewhere like this on from a stage, I'd be sitting out there and I'd say, think in my mind, "Oh, Prabhupada, don't go there. Oh, geez, that's the wrong thing to say." But he always prevailed. And whoever he was talking with left elated and fully satisfied, somehow or other. Or he would go to programs or engagements, he would call them, from humble homes to vast auditoriums with a handful of people or thousands, and sometimes two or three times a day. And each one of these, his lectures was perfect. In the evenings, he would speak in the temple, maybe even a program after, like a late-night TV show. Or we would gather in his room and yak late into the night. Here's a little story about one of those nights. After two days of travel to arrive in Sydney, Australia, on April 1st, 1972, from the book. "It's getting so late, after midnight now, officially April 2nd, and Prabhupada hasn't rested in about 2 days. His elbows are propped on a low table desk, head in his hands in a sort of reverie. Prabhupada appears to tower over us, his stature magnified by the greatness of his words, his control over every situation, his fearless intensity, and his gigantic spirit. Our point of view is always from his feet, looking up, as if he's way over our heads. His movements are so graceful, light and expressive, yet so heavy with meaning. He is guru heavy. He seems so dominant, so huge in our eyes, yet I have just seen the details in his passport as we pass through Australian customs. Abhay Charanaravinda Bhaktivedanta Swami, whose father is listed as the late Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Goswami Maharaj Prabhupada, and whose visible distinguishing mark is Vishnu Tilaka on forehead. He is just 1 meter and 60 centimeters tall, 5 feet 2.5 inches. And maybe soaking wet, he weighs 120 pounds. Many nights I'd go off to sleep, sometimes in front of his door if there was danger lurking nearby, to await his early morning bell, time for dictation again. I never saw Srila Prabhupada sleep, never once in all those years. I have one little story where I almost thought I'd caught him sleeping. Should I tell it? We were on a train to Madras from Bombay. This was in 1972, I believe. Prabhupada and I had one coach, or one cabin, air-conditioned cabin. And the devotees were spread up and down the train, sleeping in different places. So it was just Prabhupada and I in this one cabin. He said, I should sleep in the top bunk, he'll sleep below. So we worked into the night. There was a little light on a little table there. And all the main light was off, the little table light was on. Prabhupada was working. But he said, you go on up to sleep. So I went up to sleep, and I went to sleep for a while. I woke up, and the light was off, so I knew Prabhupada was in bed below me, and I thought, I'll finally catch him sleeping. I peeked over the bed. There was moonlight coming in the train window. I peeked over the edge of the bed and looked down. Prabhupada's head, the blanket was up to his nose, almost to his eyes, and his eyes were closed, and as I looked over the edge, one eye opened. He didn't say anything. Well, foiled again. Wherever I went with Srila Prabhupada, it was a great adventure. Gee, India, Africa was one of the wildest places. We were there for 6 weeks in Nairobi, Mombasa, Kenya. One adventure after another. It was my first time seeing Srila Prabhupada in such an exotic locale. I'll read a little story from that. We were exhausted, but I couldn't sleep on the plane. Okay, we're returning from Nairobi to Bombay for some programs. We were exhausted, but I couldn't sleep on the plane to Bombay, thinking about the last 6 weeks in Africa. How cool it was to see Prabhupada in action like this, in a totally unknown environment. He is the pragmatic master of sudden chance, always finding fine balance between risk and what is practical. He knows what to do in every situation. I'm spellbound by his physical beauty, whether he just woke up with heavy eyelids and a little gray stubble, or dressed to the nines for TV. I'm in love with his words as he takes on a BBC moderator or the philosopher Thomas Aquinas. Prabhupada's actions are perfect. He is at once the charming diplomat to the court of the Black King, the mighty corporate manager in horn-rimmed glasses firing memos to his 50 branches. He is the great sage mounting the dais to bring us wisdom. Prabhupada is at once a simple man. Just bring me one glass of water. And a game master thinking four moves ahead. He's inscrutable, complex, and also the modest maiden dressing for the ball. Shall I wear cotton tonight, Shamasundar, or silk? Managing Srila Prabhupada's explosive expansion was the hardest work we'd ever done, before or since. Here's a paragraph from my early days in London in June 1969. I was building a huge Rothcar almost single-handedly, one of the biggest Rothcars ever made in a suburb of London. And we had just rented a 5-story building in downtown London. It needed major remodeling. So my schedule went like this. Work all day on the Rothcar in Balham, drive to London at dark, work all night at Berry Place, then drive back to Balham at dawn to sleep a few hours. This went on day after day through June and July of 1969. Mukunda and Gurdas were furiously pounding the pavement to get planning permission for Berry Place from the Canvan Council and a Rath Yatra parade permit from Scotland Yard. Also, they are trying to raise money to satisfy my unending thirst for wood and bolts out in Balham. Hey, Mukunda, I need 100 more 6-inch carriage bolts with nuts and 200 one-inch washers. What's more, we needed money to pay the Berry Place rent, plus the rent on our individual apartments. And we have to maintain our Sankirtan program on the streets and distribute back to Godheads. Where did we get the energy? We got it from Krishna, that's for sure, knowing that Prabhupada would be coming soon. I appreciated like never before the magic of Krishna's energy, realizing how Krishna must endow the Swami with his relentless energy. Swamiji has told us that Krishna gives his devotees the transcendental power to perform inhuman feats in their desire for devotional service. Okay then, Krishna, here's the deal. I want to please my spiritual master, and there's so much work to do. So you may help me or not help me, but without your help, I will surely fail, and Srila Prabhupada will not be happy. I could tell a couple of little stories here. We seem to have some time. I'll just... a couple of little stories from the book, maybe. Here's a good one. Srila Prabhupada, this is... we became big rock stars in London, and we're appearing regularly on... and concerts and on television. And we got an invitation to fly to Amsterdam for to appear on their Top Pop show. It's the biggest show in Holland, the Hit Parade show. And Srila Prabhupada wanted to come with us. So here's a story of Srila Prabhupada on the set of Top Pop, the most watched show on Dutch television, as the leader of the famous rock band called the Radha Krishna Temple, with their hit record, Hare Krishna Mantra, at number 4 in the charts this week, with a bullet. This time, Prabhupada is not to be held back, and in early November, 10 devotees are on a plane with the Swami to Amsterdam. This is the first time most of us have traveled with Prabhupada, and we relish every moment of it, our spirits leaping at this wild adventure with our pirate leader. We're lip-syncing the song, the Hare Krishna song, as they play it. We're sitting on a stage like this, and Prabhupada's sitting in a big armchair with us. And George's opening slide guitar notes drone over the speakers, and Jamuna's low voice is barely into Hare Krishna, when 6 girls in miniskirts appear below the stage and start dancing the Watusi, the latest dance craze. Then the dry ice machine cuts in and envelops us in fog. Then the strobe lights come on. Whoa! Wait a minute, Gurdas shouts. Prabhupada is relaxed in his overstuffed Dutch armchair over there, a bemused look on his lotus face. We can't have this, Reen. And Gurdas negotiates a compromise. The wardrobe department finds some colored Madras sheets, and we drape them over the girls and teach them the Swami two-step. We unplug the strobe lights. We allow the dry ice, but we stand up so the fog only reaches our knees. And the show goes on. At the end of our song, Malati bangs the fake gong they found in the props department. And Prabhupada comes in on cue and delivers a perfect 30-second Krishna conscious capsule. And it's a wrap. Afterward, the Top Pop crew members exclaimed that it was one of the best shows they've ever done. In the many photos taken by Gurdas that day, you can see the calm, confidence, and pleasure in Srila Prabhupada's face as he enjoys a day out with his crazy children. We arrive in London very late that night, and Prabhupada is the first Swami to make the Hit Parade in recorded history. How much time do we have? 15 minutes? Okay. Here's a story of India. It'll be in the next volume. In Surat, India. This is particularly appropriate. Vishakha's here. with this entry into Surat, this was Prabhupada's first couple of months in India. He's got 20 Western disciples with him, and he's traveling around India. They've never seen Western people dancing and chanting Hare Krishna before, so the whole nation is overwhelmed. And With this entry into Surat, we immediately get the sense that we're doing something historical, a real first, that this has never happened before. That Bhaktivedanta Swami is unique in history, leading his tiny foreign army on their friendly crusade into India. And we begin to see Prabhupada now, at home and relaxed, as the true spiritual father of India, taking his place on the balcony to address the flushed and excited devotee masses like the Pope at St. Peter's, his forehead plastered with sandalwood paste, the rooms and hall around him suffused with gardenia and tuberose aromas. Prabhupada is simply loving it, and we're loving him more each second. To see our father, our best friend, our master, so well treated and revered by a whole city, makes us dizzy with new realizations that Prabhupada is a saint. And this is what a saint means, a person who is admired or venerated because of their virtue. From the Sanskrit root, sat, one who knows and abides by the truth. And we realize what the world might be if everyone was a Krishna devotee. Here's a little story from Russia. Prabhupada's face lit up like the sun when he saw these two boys enter his room behind me. He seemed to know them. They knew him, and there were no awkward moments. He fed them cherries, and we chatted all afternoon. I had never seen Prabhupada act with such charm and power. He was unspooling the lines of destiny and gently reeling these boys in. You could see Madhukar already knew much about Hinduism and that he appreciated what Prabhupada was saying and the work he was doing around the world, but he had his own agenda. But Anatoli, here was an evolved spirit in a famished land, hungry for the truth. First, Prabhupada led him through the quagmire of Max Müller and other Orientalists who had fabricated a distorted history of Aryan migrations and the Sanskrit language. Quoting the Vedas often, Prabhupada demonstrated that Vedic literatures are the oldest linguistic record, and his mastery of them was self-evident. They discussed how Sanskrit was the mother of all tongues, now absorbed into other languages. Anatoli was enthralled. This was truth far beyond what any textbook or professor could even imagine. Then a little vignette in Hong Kong. The pace was quick as we moved around the increasingly crowded park, dodging Tai Chi groups. Tap, tap, tap of Prabhupada's cane on the path, his saffron dhoti fluffed by the near ocean breeze. As we walked along, many thoughts went through my head. Are his feet cold in those open-toed slippers? His toenails, they look like pearls. Sandalwood fragrance wafts in his wake, and Prabhupada looks purposeful, chin high, chanting quietly while his tongue plays with a loose lower front tooth. He looks so spiffy this morning, pumped up to be in Hong Kong. A little vignette in New Vrindavan in the summer of 1972. For six nights, Prabhupada thrilled us with our palpable connection to ancient history. His voice rose from deep silence on that hilltop, above the chirping of crickets, occasional lowing of a cow for her calf somewhere outside in the dark, transporting us back into time immemorial when absolute truth was revealed to submissive ears. He speaks with humble yet authoritative voice, clearing his throat between sentences, smacking his lips and tongue as he talks, a liquid sound, as if he's tasting something delicious. Deep-throated, slow, rising with emphasis, speeding up to counter-tenor, stopping, looking around, questioning, like, see what I mean? Or, can you believe it? Then stabbing a gesture, withdrawing it, reforming it sideways, and slipping it home. Sometimes going, between thoughts, to give you a chance to catch up. his mobile eyebrows so bushy and strangely black. Crush, like he's crushing a succulent fruit. Nah, like a thunderclap over the hills. Krishna, like the avalanche in a far ravine. So I've taken you through a little tour of about 1,400 pages. These are just a few highlights in this huge basket of jewels called Chasing Rhinos with the Swami. And I guess if there's one paragraph I've written that sort of sums up the whole thing, it is this. His little bell tinkling, even in sleep, has become my wake-up call to happiness, transcending all other previous meanings of happiness. I cannot see enough of Prabhupada, the physical beauty of his face, especially his face, captures my eyes from morning till night. And I feast on his endless allure. He trusts me. He depends on me. How can I possibly deserve such mercy? He is in my care, I thought, forcing me to rise beyond all other considerations. I am his audience. He seems to be energized by my laugh. He tries things out. He floats ideas. I'm a sounding board, his straight man. What do you think, Shyamasundar? He catches my glance from across the stage, raises an eyebrow like, how am I doing? His smile, his laugh, especially his laugh, are all that I live for. Thank you, Srila Prabhupada. Yes, these years with Srila Prabhupada were the greatest of all adventures, full of fun and laughter. And in no way did we suffer and sacrifice. And still we are the jokers, trying to repay our beloved spiritual master for the most precious gift he has given us. The most precious gift he has given us. The Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. May the Vedic mantras you have learned never lose their meaning for you in this world or the next. Thanks to Indrajumna Swami and my other exalted God brothers and God sisters, and especially thanks to you newer generations of Krishna devotees who are gathered here today. Srila Prabhupada's gift lives on. It's continually growing and increasing, and now it's expanding like a wildfire in the dry tinder of this modern material world. Thank you so much for fanning the flames with your amazing kirtans. Thank you very much. Any questions? Do we have time? 10 minutes. Anyone have any questions or points?
Hare Krishna, I thank you very, very much. You've given us a very precious gift, which only someone who was a witness and who has become a chronic lover, a scribe, can give. How Prabhupada really was on the field and behind the closed doors, and how his eyes never slept and caught you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I would really like to ask you a question. If you could kindly try to see if Prabhupada would be, we feel he's here, but what would he say to us, generations who are
A big question. Srila Prabhupada, you could never really tell what he was going to do anywhere. The unpredictability was his amazing feature. It was always a surprise the way he acted. But I think there's no question that an event like this would just warm his heart so much to see his disciples and future the generations that he has spawned speaking so nicely and singing such nice kirtans and organizing everything so nicely. Prabhupada is so happy about what he's done, what you all have done. I know it for a fact. But I'm here to help say, keep chasing the rhino. Go for the biggest things you can. This is what Prabhupada encouraged his early shakers and movers to do, and all of you do that in a way, but Prabhupada, I'm just trying to part the veil a little bit so you can see how high Prabhupada was reaching all the time, that he didn't catch the easy fruits, he went for the one on top, and he encouraged all of us to try for that, for the biggest things for Krishna, because by doing that, I mean, it makes sense, by doing that, Krishna has to personally intervene to help you. There's no way you can do it. And then you get to see Krishna. This deepens your faith and your conviction completely when you see Krishna removing obstacles to something you're trying so hard for. Be it big or small, it's still a rhino for you. This is what I think Prabhupada would encourage his students to do in a situation like this. Go for the big one. You're all here. You've got so many tools now in this modern age. Everyone's got a device in their pockets that links them to the world and to all knowledge. Right there in this little electronic thing in your pocket. Why isn't the whole world chanting Hare Krishna? You all have the abilities to push this electronic age and make Krishna on every billboard driving down the highway and on the radio waves and we need to keep pushing big like this because spreading Krishna consciousness makes you Krishna conscious. If you want to be Krishna conscious, you've got to try to spread Krishna consciousness in whatever way is natural for you. And under the direction and management of Srila Prabhupada and his lineage, his sampradaya, his children, the spiritual masters that he has produced behind him. Thank you. That's a good question. Thanks. Chase the rhino. Let's go.